This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and at 1300 GMT on Tuesday, 3rd of September, these are our main stories. A Russian missile strike on the Ukrainian city of Poltava has killed more than 40 people and injured almost 200 more. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say almost 130 prisoners were killed during an attempted jailbreak. And the former chief executive of Volkswagen is going on trial, 9 years after the carmaker was found to have cheated laboratory tests on the vehicle's emissions. Also in this podcast... Mongolia welcomes President Putin, but will he be arrested there? As we record this podcast, news is coming in of a Russian missile strike that, according to Ukraine's President Zelensky, has killed more than 40 people. The target was Poltava, a city in the center of Ukraine. More than 180 people were wounded. Speaking in the last hour, Mr. Zelensky said it was a very difficult day for Ukraine. We got more details from the BBC monitoring team's Russia and Ukraine specialist, Vitaly Shevchenko.
The Ukrainian president said that it was carried out using two ballistic missiles, and it hit an educational establishment, which he called an Institute of Communications. Now, there are indications that this institute was used by the Ukrainian military to train to use communications on the battlefield. So there are reports that the strike targeted Ukrainian military. The defense ministry in Kiev also issued a statement saying that it's an awful day in Poltava, and these people were hit while on their way to the bomb shelter, so they did not have enough time to evacuate. Many were trapped under the rubble. The Ukrainian military says that 25 people have been rescued, and search and rescue operations are still ongoing. Now, Poltava is fairly removed from the front line, so it's not seen the most vicious Russian missile attacks, unlike some of the Ukrainian cities in the east and northeastern Ukraine, such as Kharkiv. Now, that's all changed. Clearly, tragic developments in Poltava. 3 days of mourning have been declared in the city, and Ukraine is trying to find out how this happened just at a time when it's trying to improve its air defences.
Ever since Ukraine had launched that incursion into Russia, there's been speculation that Vladimir Putin would want to hit back at Ukraine in a way that caused more serious casualties than in the past, perhaps as a form of punishment. Is it possible that that's what we're seeing here?
It is possible, Paul, but let's not forget that this and earlier massive missile strikes that Russia's been carrying out over the past weeks, they are part of Russia's previous strategy. They're nothing that Russia has not done before. So it could also just as equally be argued that Russia would have tried to do something like that anyway, Kursk or no Kursk.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Today's attack comes after a weekend of extensive drone strikes carried out by Ukraine on Russia. They targeted a refinery and power station deep within the country. The Kremlin claims the majority of the drones were intercepted. James Patton Rogers is executive director of the Cornell Brooks Tech Policy Institute and has advised NATO and the United Nations on drone warfare in the past. He told the BBC's Catherine Bierohunga how Ukraine had attempted to match Russia's drone capabilities.
Russia does rely quite heavily on Iran's for its drone designs, for its supply of drones, but Ukraine has tried to match this capacity by really allowing for government support, deregulation of the rocket industry, of the defense manufacturing industry, and the popping up of these local production and industrial hubs that allow for a range of very different and technically specific drones, some used for tactical battlefield use, like the smaller first-person view quadcopter systems, all the way up to much longer systems that have a range of anything up to 800 miles. So Ukraine has really diversified its defense industry, and as a result of that, can present quite a lot of powerful systems on the battlefield.
What does it mean for the direction of the conflict? Because now Ukraine is taking Russian territory, but it also has this massive front line at home. So how can it deploy this technology to try and take on Russia?
Well, it's exactly because it can deploy this technology that it can take on Russia, or at least it's trying desperately to defend itself, of course, against an offensive Russia that started this invasion. What these drones allow is to strike deep behind enemy lines. What Russia has been doing over recent months and weeks is pushing its supplies further and further back and making sure that its attack aircraft are further back from the front line. That is in reaction to the effectiveness of Ukrainian drone systems. And so as Ukraine increases the amount of drones it can fire, and also the range of those drones, then it means that any of the Russian aircraft that are attacking Ukraine itself, well, they become less effective. They have to be moved further back. They have to fly further for their sorties. And they become increasingly vulnerable to these drone attacks that are coming in. Now, alongside that, of course, the Ukrainians are also bombing ammunition sites, industrial sites, and the oil and gas making facilities of the Russian state. All of this is in a desperate attempt to try and blunt the war making industry of Russia, to make it too damaging to continue this war.
James Patton Rogers. It wasn't drones, but missiles, which seemed to have been at the centre of a treason trial in Russia. A court in Moscow sentenced a prominent scientist to 15 years in jail. It's been reported he was accused of handing over secrets connected with Russia's hypersonic missile program. Alexander Shipolyuk was the director of an institute that's part of the Russian Academy of Sciences. Russia's state news agency TASS said he specialised in aerophysical research. More details from Steve Rosenberg in Moscow.
Alexander Shipolyuk was sentenced to 15 years in a high-security penal colony. He's one of a dozen Russian physicists arrested since 2015 who have some connection to the development of hypersonic technology or to institutions that work on it. All have been charged with treason. Because the trial was held behind closed doors, the details of the case haven't been made public.
Steve Rosenberg. Mongolia finds itself in a rather tricky diplomatic situation. It's currently playing host to Vladimir Putin. Mongolia and Russia are old allies. The visit's to mark the anniversary of a key battle they fought together against Japan in 1939. But there is an arrest warrant out for President Putin issued by the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Mongolia is an ICC signatory. Still, Mr. Putin was welcomed at the airport by an honour guard and full military fanfare. The visit is about more than pomp and mutual gratitude. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has said the two countries have the potential for gas and other energy cooperation deals. And as far as these two Mongolians were concerned, the International Criminal Court's warrant should be ignored.
The ICC is an international organisation. It's true that we are a member country, but it doesn't mean we have to follow every order. And arresting Putin during this visit would be immoral and improper. China and Russia are both very important to us as neighbours.
We Mongolians do not support the arrest of Putin. I don't support it because it's bad manners.
Russia appears confident there will be no arrest of its president. A Kremlin spokesman last week said they had no concerns. And it seems that confidence is well-founded, as our Asia-Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton explains.
Mongolia says it's politically neutral, like Switzerland, and in recent years it's portrayed itself as an unbiased third party on the global stage. It's hosted high-profile diplomatic gatherings to flesh out difficult topics from climate change to regional security. But that doesn't change the fact that Mongolia is a landlocked country sandwiched between two comparatively rich, powerful nations, Russia and China. Mongolia is a huge country. It takes up half the size of Europe, but it has a relatively small population, 3.3 million people. It's almost completely dependent on trade with its two giant neighbors. In the face of this, the Mongolian government started a third neighbor strategy by forging close ties with countries other than China and Russia, like the United States. A series of Western leaders have recently walked the red carpet in Ulaanbaatar. So, Mr. Putin's arrival has placed the country in a difficult position, testing its neutrality. The Kremlin says the country's leaders will discuss the building of a natural gas pipeline that would go through Mongolia, carrying resources to China. Since Ulaanbaatar is dependent on Russia for fuel and energy, such a pipeline would also be very valuable. Mongolia's economy has been hard hit by climate change, killing off scores of livestock and forcing it to look for other ways to survive. Ulaanbaatar could be trading one headache for another. If officials fail to arrest Vladimir Putin, the country could face prosecution by the International Criminal Court and serious criticism from its third neighbors. But presumably, after eyeing a powerful Russia to its north and a pro-Russia China to the south, that's a risk the Mongolians have decided to take.
Celia Hatton, if you were listening to our earlier podcast, you'd have heard a special BBC report on Israel's illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. These seem to be supported by organisations which, in turn, are funded by the Israeli government. The outposts they're building may be new, but the settler movement dates back far longer, as Dror Etkes, an Israeli expert on settlement activity, explains.
This is a phenomenon, actually, which goes back, we can see the beginning of it in the early 1980s, but it started to pick up, actually, in the last decade, and especially since 2017, when Trump came into office. And these entities, these outposts, are usually organized around one family, one couple, in their late 20s, 30s, and then a bunch of youngsters, teenagers, very often, people who are not visiting regularly schools, who are channeled by the welfare authorities to work, volunteer in these outposts, in these entities. The idea behind it is to establish an outpost, usually very remote from any other Israeli settlement or existing outpost, in the middle of Palestinian agricultural and herding area, in order to use the herd, and we're talking sometimes about sheep, goats, sometimes about cattle, in order to use these herds to deport deliberately Palestinians from agricultural and herding areas. These outposts had changed completely in large tracts of the West Bank. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of dunams, which had become inaccessible or very, very dangerous for Palestinians because of these outposts. We're talking about mafia. These outposts, settlers who are running these outposts, they're part of a larger system which is completely backed by all state organs. I'm talking about the Israeli police, I'm talking about the Israeli military, I'm talking about different Israeli ministries who are financing these outposts. And this Palestinian family who is in danger to lose their land has no chance, absolutely no chance against these people. We're not talking about lack of enforcement. We're talking about actual violation of the law, also the Israeli law, not only the international law, which has a very, very clear purpose to depopulate larger tracts of the West Bank and to transfer these lands to Israeli settlers who are moving into this area. And this is a system which several Israeli public and governmental organs are very, very intensively involved with. By financing and by backing, nothing could work without the Israeli state decision to carry out this campaign.
Dror Etkes. Still to come.
I love the Sikh warriors, and like they would represent what Sikhs would wear, let's say if they went into battle.
We tell you all about the Sikh superheroes. It's one of the biggest corporate scandals of modern times. The German giant Volkswagen was found to have cheated laboratory tests to make their cars appear more eco-friendly. It's already cost Volkswagen more than $30 billion in fines, compensation and legal fees. But Tuesday sees the company's former head go on trial for his role in the affair. Martin Winterkorn faces up to 10 years in prison if convicted. But then, as our international business correspondent Theo Leggett told me, the effects of this affair were widespread and long-lasting.
It was a huge scandal. This was a scandal that rocked the entire car industry and rocked the German corporate establishment as well. This was Volkswagen, the Volkswagen empire, which doesn't just include Volkswagen cars. It's Audi, it's Porsche, it's Seat, it's Skoda. One of the jewels in the crown of German industry. And what happened was in 2015, the US environmental authorities accused Volkswagen of deliberately fitting software in its cars that enabled them to get through emissions testing by artificial means. And Volkswagen eventually did own up to this. And what had been happening was Volkswagen was on a sales drive in the United States. It wanted to sell more cars there, and it wanted to sell diesel cars there. And it did a marketing campaign based on clean diesels. The problem was its engines weren't that clean. And in order to meet US emissions standards, which were very stringent, it either would end up with cars that didn't perform very well or weren't very reliable, or it fitted software.
So that's what happened with Volkswagen. But Martin Winterkorn's facing a criminal trial. What exactly are the offences that he's alleged to have committed?
First of all, fraud, that people who bought cars that were fitted with these so-called defeat devices that turned emission controls off in the lab, on in the lab and then off when they were on the road, didn't know what they were buying and suffered financial losses as a result. Market manipulation, because Volkswagen wasn't transparent with Volkswagen investors about what they were doing, and the share price fell in the wake of all this. And also perjury. He's accused of giving false testimony to a German parliamentary committee which was investigating the scandal. Now, he would have gone on trial years ago, but he's been suffering from poor health, which is why it's only now, 9 years after the scandal erupted, that we're seeing him take the stand.
You mentioned there that the share price fell, but briefly, Martin, in the sort of longer term, was Volkswagen affected, their sales and their financial position?
They were affected very significantly. There was, first of all, that $30 billion loss, which is, you know, part of its history now. But also, the entire strategy of the company had to be overhauled. In the wake of all of this, Volkswagen moved away from producing diesel cars. They were unmarketable for a while, and it focused instead on electric cars. And German politicians sort of followed suit and decided to launch their own campaigns against diesel cars in particular, but also against petrol cars. So this is why nowadays we have these looming dates when European governments will ban the sale of new petrol and diesel cars, 2030 in the United Kingdom, for example, and everybody's going to have to move electric. That was a move that probably would have happened at some point, but it was accelerated to a great degree by the Volkswagen scandal.
Theo Leggett. Makala Prison may be the largest in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but there were only ever supposed to be 1,500 people incarcerated there. At the last count, however, there were 12,000, eight times more than its capacity. So it's safe to say these are challenging conditions at the best of times. And when inmates apparently attempted a mass breakout, the result was widespread death and injury. The DRC's Interior Minister, Jacquemain Shabani Lukou, posted a video statement on social media outlining the extent of the casualties.
Le bilan provisoire sur le plan humain s'élève.
The provisional human death toll stands at 129, including 24 from gunshot wounds. The others died in a stampede, from suffocation, and some women were raped. 59 people were also injured. The government is pleased that calm has been restored, but condemns these unfortunate incidents and offers its deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of the victims.
An investigation's underway to identify and prosecute those responsible. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Kugoi, told us what we know so far.
On Monday at around 2 a.m. in the morning, some inmates set on fire the administration block and a couple of other buildings in this facility. So in the process, some of the inmates, out of panic, attempted to find their way out and just to run away from the fire. So a stampede occurred. And in the process, almost 129 people died.
And yet we also heard the Interior Minister there talking about women being raped. Do we have any idea how that managed to happen in the middle of the kind of chaos you're describing?
Because this is a very overcrowded facility. And so there have been challenges in terms of investment. And so it's become very difficult because in the course of the chaos then, you'd have the male and female inmates interacting. The prison officers must have been overwhelmed by this incident. But this was a breakout that has never been witnessed before because we had a similar incident in 2017. But the scale of this is huge.
Richard Kugoy. Pope Francis is nothing if not ambitious. At the age of 87, he's just arrived in Indonesia, where he aims to promote peace between Christians and Muslims and try to persuade people to take climate change more seriously. And lest anyone should doubt his get up and go, the Pope will continue by visiting East Timor, Singapore and Papua New Guinea, a 12-day tour in total. There has been some concession to the pontiff's relatively advanced age. We're told he'll rest for a day after what's been a 13-hour flight to reach the Indonesian capital. But then he'll have a series of meetings and a public appearance, where, as our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head explained, he's expected to talk about Indonesia's different religions and religious groupings.
It's got the world's largest Muslim population. Islam is not the official religion. Many faiths are tolerated and do coexist. There have been examples of violence, particularly with the rise of Islamic extremism that we saw particularly about 20 years ago, and Christian communities have been targeted. I think the bigger issue that is raised, particularly by human rights groups, is a general reduction of tolerance of religious practices and the use of things like the blasphemy law. Been used in quite a number of high-profile cases against people perceived to have insulted Islam, the intolerance of other factions of Islam as well, other splinter groups. You know, generally, I don't think that the Pope is going to highlight those. He's going to highlight the positives, which is that, in his view, Indonesia is still a great example of multi-religious cooperation and cohabitation, given that in many parts of the world there's much less of that. Indonesia is also, from his point of view, you know, a kind of model non-aligned country, a country that opens itself up diplomatically to all sides. It's a big and important global player. And the Vatican has, for many, many years, going back decades, made a particular point of working on its relationships with successive Indonesian governments, a secular state, remember, to enhance the protection and the status of the relatively small Catholic population. It's only about 3% of the population.
And briefly, Jonathan, I mean, climate change, an issue in all the countries that the Pope's visiting. What's his message and who's his audience?
His audience, he hopes, will be the entire population. And, you know, Indonesia is, for all its majority Islam, religion is taken very seriously. He's a high status visitor from another faith. I think, of course, the Roman Catholic population, which is distributed very widely in Indonesia, and many people will have to travel a long way to have a chance to see him in the capital, Jakarta, which is the only place in Indonesia he's going. For them, it's obviously of enormous significance. It's 35 years since the last visit by a pope to Indonesia, so people have been waiting a long time to have the chance, for many coming into Jakarta tomorrow, to celebrate Mass with him in a stadium, and that's very, very special for them.
Jonathan Head. We were speaking there about climate change. The effects of global warming are many and varied. And a new report serves to emphasise just how many different areas of life can be altered. Bangladesh is currently recovering from recent flooding, which displaced more than 5 million people, a problem which scientists say can only get worse as temperatures rise. And the charities UNICEF and Save the Children say this could harm efforts to reduce child marriage. So what's the connection? Greer Jackson explains.
The heavy rains in Bangladesh have shattered many lives. Here, a man is carrying chickens on his head in a cage, protecting them as brown, ankle-deep water rushes all around him. It was a flood just like this one that led a girl, who we'll call Adaya, to be married off. Her family lost everything and had to leave their home.
I was so young, just 16 years old then. I did not want to get married, but I was married anyway. If I could have stayed in school, I could have been someone. I could have joined the army, but I have not been able to change anything in my life.
Underpinning child marriage is poverty, insecurity, and gender inequality. But increasingly, climate change is playing a role. It's making extreme weather like heavy monsoons and heat waves much more common. And that is increasing the risk factors for girls being married before they're 18 years old. That's according to Gabrielle Szabo from the charity Save the Children.
So I think, say, if we imagine a family that's experienced a climate disaster, there's often huge financial pressure that comes with, say, losing a crop or even being forced to migrate because you can no longer earn an income in the area you once lived. That family is then forced to make some of those tricky decisions about whether they'd be better able to provide for their daughters if they were to marry them to another family.
What does the data say on that increased risk?
There was a study done in Bangladesh a few years ago that showed very young adolescent girls, so those who are much less likely to be child brides, were actually twice as likely to marry in the year that followed an extreme heat wave.
Gabrielle fears that not only could more girls be at risk because of climate change, but also they may be forced to marry even younger.
Yeah, so this is one of the, I guess, really concerning aspects of crises, is that the more desperate families become, the lower those ages tend to go.
But in Bangladesh, community hubs like the one where Shibnaza Harin works are fighting back.
We can prevent child marriage by making the community aware of the issue with campaigns on the TV, radio and the internet. And we can put on events in the community where we talk about child marriage and its negative consequences.
Thanks to initiatives like this, Bangladesh has managed to reduce the number of child brides. 10 years ago, 65% of girls got married early. Now it's 56%. But now climate change could diminish that progress, warns Gabrielle from Save the Children.
The kind of extra heartbreaking piece, I think, around Bangladesh is actually a country that had been making huge progress to reduce rates of child marriage. And now, you know, this increasing climate disasters are creating real barriers that are slowing down progress and, you know, perhaps threatening to push back progress.
That report from Greer Jackson. It's long been a complaint about superheroes that, while they may have had very different superpowers, they were all, to a man and woman, white. Now, that has changed in recent years. Most notably, there was the Oscar-winning film Black Panther. But there have also been Middle Eastern and Asian superheroes and superheroines. Now, Khalsa Toy Store in the English city of Leicester has created action figures that look like Sikhs, and they're spreading around the world. As BBC Asian Network's Raj Kaur Bilku has been finding out, the idea was born out of a chat between two friends.
Belinda's kids in Leicester are obsessed with their new toys. Tara is 10 years old.
I love that it's like they're Sikh warriors and like they would represent what Sikhs would wear, like, let's say if they went into battle.
And Zorawar is 7.
They're so inspiring and they're so fun to play with.
Khalsa Toy Store was created in 2021 by two friends from Coventry, making action figures based on Sikh history and culture, the first of its kind in the world. Hi, Sook.
Hi, Raj. Welcome to Khalsa Toy Store.
I've come to their distribution centre in Leicester's Melton Road to meet co-founder Sook Singh.
So I was with my business partner. We were at his house and he has two young boys. And they said, Dad, why don't we have any toys that look like us? And that was kind of like a light bulb moment where we thought, actually, yeah, that's true. Like, why don't we have something that, you know, represents our image, our physical characteristics, because we have a very distinct and unique appearance.
Word has spread far and wide online, and now the company is getting orders from all corners of the world.
We've got quite a global reach now. So we've had a lot of orders from Canada, a lot of orders from America, and now we see an increase in demand in Australia and India as well.
Ordained Sikhs have a very distinct appearance, including uncut hair, wearing a turban, and a ceremonial dagger called a kirpan. These are all featured in the action figures.
We wanted to create characters which are fiction-based, and the reason we did that is just to keep, you know, the utmost respect in terms of how these toys will be used, you know, with children might be thrown on the floor. We can understand why some people would find that, like, can hurt their sentiments.
Action figures have been around for decades, from Superman to Spider-Man. So why are these figurines such a big deal for the Sikh community?
It's a very good question.
Sukhwinder Singh from Sri Guru Nanak Sahib Academy travels the world teaching about Sikh history.
Sikhs, we are very small in numbers, and wherever we go, we stand out because we are that visible. It can be a problem when it comes to bullying or getting picked on, because if you look different, then you're going to be a target. When they see these figurines, it gives them that confidence that they need to be able to go out there and be proud of who they are.
As for Khalsa Toy Store, what are the plans moving forward, Sukh?
So we want to make animations which will allow children to watch them and take away a piece of education from that as well, about Sikh history, about Sikh culture, about our heritage.
That report from Raj Kaur Bilku. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Hool. The producer was Rachel Wright. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.